The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Then to the conclusion under our second point, flowing somewhat out of our survey of the term charisma. Since it's the case that both in its origin and continuation, its ongoing life, the church exists solely by divine charis, grace, the whole church then, in all of its aspects and activities, is properly seen as charismatic. The life of faith is, as such, by charis, Ephesians 2:8. And so, in its entirety, from beginning to end, is charismatic. So then, to identify certain gifts in the church as charismatic, and in this way, distinguish them from others, runs the risk of distorting and narrowing Paul's perspective. And when, further, as often happens, it seems to me, a charismatic, used in the restricted sense that I'm speaking against here, when charismatic, as often happens, becomes virtually synonymous with gifts, or at least with what is alleged to be the real gifts, the result is nothing less than impoverishing. I might say here in passing, what we're saying in effect is directed toward kinds of schematizations that we would put on Paul in this manner. I think along a related angle, the way in which we distinguish sometimes, the distinction is made between the gifts of the Spirit and the fruit of the Spirit, in its own way betrays a schematizing that is foreign to Paul, especially if the fruit are somehow not seen as gifts. So all in all, I think we ought to view the matter this way. While on the one side we certainly want to maintain that some gifts involve distinctive endowment which is beyond the natural or created capacities of the recipient. Certainly, I'm saying, some gifts involve a special kind of endowment, gifting, which runs beyond the natural or the created capacities of the recipient. Think, for instance, of revelatory gifts. And I'm not denying that there is that kind of gifting, of course. While recognizing that, still, it's fair to say that the direction of Paul's teaching is as follows. Any capacity of the believer brought under the controlling power of God's grace and functioning in His service is a charisma. We're stating this as the direction of Paul's teaching, following out of our word survey. Any capacity of the believer brought under the controlling power of God's grace and functioning in God's service is a charisma. So to hit the bottom line again, charismatic and Christian are synonymous. The Christian life is, or at least it is to be, a charismatic life. The Church of Christ as a whole, is the charismatic movement. In the third place, perspective, just touch for a couple of minutes on what we can pinpoint as the fully theological, or perhaps better, Trinitarian character of the gifts. And there are two sides here, A and B. And I'll let you know when I move from A to B. To refer, on the one side now, to refer to the gifts listed in Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, Ephesians 4, as spiritual gifts is only partly correct. In view of the functional unity that exists between Christ and the Spirit, a matter we have given considerable attention to, in view of the functional unity that exists between Christ and the Spirit, dating from Christ's exaltation, Christ as life-giving Spirit, the work of the two, Christ and the Spirit, is inseparable. And so that's why we find, then, in Ephesians 4, 7 and following, that it is the ascended Christ who gives gifts. Further, 4, 7 and following. Further, the Spirit in all his activities is epangelia to patros, the promise of the Father. Acts 1, 4. And a Bible with good marginal references will tell you the other places to at that point where that expression occurs. Acts 1, 4. So that in keeping with what is the conventional usage in Paul anyway, the more general reference to theos, God as the giver of gifts, as we have that in Romans 12, 3 and 1 Corinthians 12, 28, that reference to theos ought to be taken as referring implicitly to the Father. At any rate, 1 Corinthians 12, 4 through 6, 1 Corinthians 12, 4 through 6, a passage that we'll be looking at later on in this hour. So I'll just comment on it here in passing. 1 Corinthians 12, 4 through 6, and you can compare with it Ephesians 4, 4 through 6. These passages provide a distinctly Trinitarian perspective on the bestowal of gifts. So, we need to remember that the gifts are not only spiritual, but Christological, and if you will, patrological, referring to the Father. And this might seem a kind of obvious point, hope it is, but it reminds us of a certain breadth and outlook that we must have, and a breadth that corrects what, again, looking at the contemporary situation, is by no means an imaginary danger or tendency, and that is the tendency toward a one-sided emphasis on the Spirit when it comes to gifts in the church. And it seems to me, at least it strikes me, this is just a personal impression, I wouldn't want to put a lot of weight on it. It seems to me that in certain sectors, that emphasis on the Spirit is carried out in such a fashion that we end up with a virtually non-theistic base for the Spirit. At any rate, B side. After all that we have said, emphasizing the Trinitarian outlook that we must have, it would still, I think, be wrong to overlook the accent that there is on the Spirit, particularly in 1 Corinthians 12 through 14. The giving of gifts is a matter of the phanerosis to pneumatos, the manifestation of the Spirit, 1 Corinthians 12, 7. Look at the verses that follow, 8 and 9, spelling that out. Or again, in verse 11, it is the Spirit who distributes to each one as he wills. And perhaps at this point, we could comment on Paul's use of the adjective pneumatika, the substantively used neuter plural adjective, as he uses that in the context of 1 Corinthians 12:14 to refer to the gifts, the spiritual things or gifts, giving it a specific reference to the gifts that he's talking about. Some maintain that this usage is not so much Paul's choice, but that it's a matter of Paul picking up on the preference and the specialized usage of the party that he's concerned about in the among his Corinthian readers. I'm not sure what to say about that, but I think regardless of what we would decide there, it's difficult to disprove that in 14:1, and compare with that 12:1, it's difficult to disprove that in 14:1 Paul has made the usage of this substantive a virtual synonym for charismata. Charismata are pneumatica. Again, showing the close connection with the Spirit. And also we could comment here on Romans 1:11, which is the one place in the New Testament where we have the expression spiritual gift, that is the combination noun-adjective, charisma, pneumatikon. That qualification of the charisma as pneumatikon then shows how closely Paul associates the Spirit with the gifts given to the church. And then how, so you see then how naturally and appropriately, how natural and appropriate it is for him to ascribe these gifts to the Spirit's work. The point here is, in Romans 1:11, the point is hardly to distinguish some gifts from others that are not of the Spirit. And I think further, that expression in Romans 1:11 is best taken more broadly or indefinitely without Paul having any one specific particular gift in mind. That's a matter of more close exegesis that we might want to change our minds on. In the fourth place, or perspective four, if you will, this concerns the pointedly ministerial or functional character of the gifts. The pointedly functional or ministerial character of the gifts. They are variously distributed in the church. The consideration that controls from beginning to end, the all-controlling consideration, is that the gifts are given for service in the church. Service in the church. And here, perhaps the clearest indication for our thinking, we need to look at 1 Corinthians 12:4-6. 1 Corinthians 12:4-6. A variety, various distribution of gifts, but the same Spirit. Variety of ministries, and the same Lord. A variety of workings, but the same God, who works all things in all. Now these verses, you see, have These verses have a clearly triadic structure to them, Trinitarian structure, as we were just calling attention to. And I think on the best, the understanding of the verses then will always have to, the exegesis will want to be controlled by the deliberate triadic structure that Paul is developing there. I think that, the best understanding then is that the expressions, the terms gifts, charismaton, verse 4, ministries, diakonion, verse 5, and workings or activities, energeimaton, verse 6. These terms do not have reference to different entities, but define each other. They reciprocate on each other, so that from the angle of our interest, we can say that the terms in verse 5 and 6, ministries and workings, those two terms serve to identify the character of the charismaton, the gifts. And these terms make plain that the gifts, the terms ministries and workings, make plain that the gifts listed, which Paul goes on to list in verses 8 through 10, those gifts are to function for service within the context of the church. Service within the context of the church. The diverse manifestation of the Spirit is, verse 7, pros to sumpheron. That is, the diverse manifestation of the Spirit is for the common good. For the common good. The consideration, again, that identifies the purpose of all gifts, the consideration that identifies the purpose of all gifts and regulates their exercise is the edification of the church. Pros tein oikodomein teis ekklesias, for the edification of the church. Verse 12. Compare verse 26. The question concerns the reference to church in 1 Corinthians 12, and particularly whether it's church as institute or organism. And I think that the best way of viewing the situation is to see that Paul is not really thinking in terms of that distinction. I think he's thinking in terms, in very organic terms. Surely that's clear here, if anywhere in the Scriptures. That is, the church as organism, as body. But he's also speaking of that organism, that body, as being manifested in the particular situation at Corinth, where there's also a localization. And I leave it to the doctrine of church to spell out the way in which the New Testament can oscillate between unity, organic unity of the church in every place, and the organism of the church in one place. But and further, I think it's clearly the church in which, as the end of the chapter says, apostles, prophets, teachers, and others have been set with delegated function. I think you're asking a wider question that we just are not warranted in trying to get in. It's an important question, but we just can't really get into at this point. Now, from what I've observed under this fourth point as to the functional or ministerial character of the gifts, that I think brings us to make an observation which is kind of a corollary. And it's a point I just wanted to touch on because I think it flows out of what we've been discussing right here. We'll come back to it in a sense later on, discussing particularly tongues. And this is a corollary that concerns the beneficial experiences, the reactions that the exercise of a particular gift may bring to its recipient. The, however you want to describe it, the subjective, the emotional, the affective response. That is no doubt present for the recipient in the exercise of the gift. But the point here, you see, is that in terms of this principle of the ministerial principle, the principle of edification, that these beneficial experiences, if we can use that way of putting it, these beneficial experiences are always aspects of the gift and so are not independent of the gift. They are not independent gifts. They are aspects of the gift. And so they are not independent of the principle of the edification of the body, but they are strictly subordinate to that principle. Perhaps not too misleadingly, to make a point here, we can speak of the this experience that the recipient of the gift has as kind of a fringe benefit which accompanies the gift. But the rationale, the place for the gift itself, is always to be established by the principle of the edification of the church. In the fifth place, and here we want simply within the framework of this third section, where we're setting out basic perspectives, to assert, in a sense, what we have already established, I think, from our discussion yesterday. And the fifth point, then, is this assertion. The view that certain gifts, for example, tongues, the view that certain gifts are the almost invariable accompaniment that serves to evidence baptism with the Holy Spirit as a distinct, usually post-conversion experience of the individual believer. I'm saying the view that certain gifts are the invariable or almost invariable accompaniment that serves to evidence baptism with the Holy Spirit as a distinct post-conversion or usually post-conversion experience of the individual believer. That view finds no support in the New Testament and, in fact, runs counter to its teaching on the baptism or gift of the Holy Spirit. And we can go on here to say that, in this respect, no gift can claim a privileged position, as it were. No gift can claim a privileged position or have its place in the life of the church maintained as a component in a second blessing or spirit baptism theology. Each gift must be considered in its own right. Each gift must be examined, so far as possible, in terms of its distinguishing character, its specific function, and as that function is always for the edification of the church. In the sixth place, the relationship of gift and office. Gift, charisma, and office. Now, both in exegetical and dogmatic discussion, this question has been much, sometimes intensely debated in the past 75 to 100 years. And it's a question that, in a way, will constantly or at many points be interacting with in our subsequent discussion. What we want to do here, because it is a basic area or locus of concern, we want to touch on it here and to touch on it so in a way that we distance ourselves from different variations of a viewpoint that has proved to be very influential. We want to set ourselves apart from a certain viewpoint about to be expressed that has been very influential, particularly within a critical tradition, and at the same time express what is most basic on this issue, even if our expression is somewhat put in somewhat negative terms. Our point here is this. Any tension or opposition between gift, the Spirit, on the one side, and office, on the other side, is totally foreign to the New Testament. Any kind of Spirit, office, gift, office dialectic is totally foreign to the New Testament. To go on in that a bit. Any construction by which the Spirit is seen as a principle of unstructured freedom or untamed spontaneity in opposition to considerations of established order or stable structures. I'm saying any construction now by which the Spirit is seen as a principle of unordered or unstructured freedom and so seen in opposition or even in conflict to considerations of order and stable structure, any such construction is not based on the teaching of the New Testament, but it reflects, I'm inclined to make the judgment, it reflects the alien problematics of westernized post-enlightenment, post-conscient ontology and epistemology. And I was going to say, I think that holds even where Kant and the Enlightenment may never have even been heard of. The harmony, and that's our concern, of course, on this point, the harmony between gift and office, Spirit and office, the harmony that exists in this respect in the New Testament is clear in a number of ways, and I can only here indicate very quickly. what certain couple considerations that stand on the surface. That harmony is clear, for instance, from the official use of charisma in the pastorals, that is, attaching it to a particular ministerial office. 1 Timothy, thinking about the statements bearing on Timothy, 1 Timothy 4:14, 2 Timothy 1:6. And, of course, a kind of a backhanded recognition of this point is the fact that this usage of charisma, this official usage of charisma, as we could describe it, in the pastorals, is one of the arguments alleged against the Pauline authorship. Presumably you can't have the kind of spirit you have in Paul and the spirit in the pastorals. But that brings up a whole other problem that we won't... There's also, in the Pauline materials, I would say, the plain office character of the apostolate. The plain office character of the apostolate. We have even the noun, apostole. That's a point that, by the, I say that that's plain. I'm still inclined to say that's plain. James Dunn challenges that rather massively, his latest book on Jesus and the Spirit, where he discusses the apostolate. But we won't try to interact with that here. So to sum up, as I've heard it put, I think probably some of you have too, in the words of our president, that is the president of this institution, the Spirit is the Spirit both of ardor and order. Ardor and order, the one and same Spirit. I'll leave you to work that out. In the seventh place, not trying to suggest a certain element of perfection on this listing, but this is, as a matter of fact, the last one. This concerns the matter of the composition of the gifts, the composition of the gifts in Romans 12. Excuse me, the composition of the lists of the gifts, makeup of the lists of the gifts, as we have those lists in Romans 12. 6 through 8, 1 Corinthians 12 through 10 and 28, and Ephesians 4:11. These lists are not complete. These gifts are not intended to be complete. Surely they are selective and representative. This is a point that is frequently pointed out, but I'm inclined to say it's more often overlooked. However, well, there's a recognition, a rather widespread recognition, at least in the what I think would be fair to describe as the more careful exegetical literature, that these gifts are selective, and these lists are selective and representative. So far, Paul's rationale for selection, the rationale for Paul's choice in the listing that is given, Paul's rationale in each case has not been demonstrated conclusively. And I'm not going to try to suggest that here. Still, while we recognize, want to keep in mind what I've just been saying, it's possible to make at least two generalizations. I think we can go on to make two generalizations about the composition of these listings when we take them as a whole. That is, looking in, not looking in turn at each segment, but the overall situation. Two generalizations. First of all, I think we need to remember that too sharp a line should not be drawn between many of the gifts. Don't draw too abrupt or sharp a line between many of the gifts. For example, I'm inclined to say it's doubtful whether anyone has successfully demonstrated exegetically a clear difference between the word of wisdom, the logos sophios, and the word of knowledge, the logos gnoseos, that Paul indicates in 1 Corinthians 12:8. And similarly, I think it's difficult to distinguish clearly between charismata, diamaton, the gifts of healing, and the energeimata, dunameon, working of miracles, in 1 Corinthians 12:9-10. And a somewhat different kind of observation, I think that, in a sense, presupposing here, making observation that presupposes conclusions will establish later about the apostles and the prophets, I think we can say that in the listing that we have in 1 Corinthians 12:28, where Paul lists first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, the offices that follow, or the functions that follow, pick up on an element that is present in what precedes. That is simply to say, the apostles are also prophets and teachers. The prophets are also teachers. If that's debatable to you, we'll be addressing that later. So I think what these observations suggest is a degree of overlap between certain gifts, as well as the exercise, in some instances, of more than one of the gifts or functions by a given individual. A certain amount of overlap, as well as the fact, at least in some instances, that a given individual exercises more than one of the functions described. And I think that's a warning, then, to us. These observations bring us to warn ourselves not to construe what is undoubtedly the diversity of spiritual gifts, but we are not to construe this diversity in terms of our Western mentality with its preference, its predilection for the specialist, so that we begin to use these lists, make them function as kind of a spiritual inventory by which I try to find my specialty, my niche, so to speak, that distinguishes me or sets me apart from others. Clearly, that is not what Paul has in mind. All right, that was the first. I have them down here as A or B. That was my first generalization on the listings. Yes. Well, the question is, what positively does Paul have in mind if it's not a matter of this specialist mentality? If I haven't wanted to caricature, by the way, in that it just seems to me that there is just that that tendency in the atmosphere of our culture. I think the point to be made, first of all, is what we began with on this seventh point, and that is the representative character of these listings. He's not trying to be complete, so that the lists are not intended, are not given by Paul as if every believer, even in the Corinthian situation, has to find himself or herself in terms of that listing. And I think those lists are representative of the manifold working of the Spirit in the variation, the diversity of his working in the Corinthian situation at that time, and could be explicated, the matter of gifts could be explicated along in terms of the very wide range of meaning that charisma has, as we tried to show in our survey under preceding point, so that I think ultimately considered the matter of the gift of the Spirit is the specific thing that the Spirit is doing through me according to His Word in the context of the church where He has placed me to minister. I think that there we could go on to set out certain guidelines that enable us how to identify just what those functions are. But I don't think the New Testament is ever concerned at any place to spell out an exhaustive church order, as it were, in terms of listing specifically what every gift that there is. Yes. I think the question concerns a generalization made earlier that any capacity of the believer taken over by the Holy Spirit can be viewed as a charisma. And I guess, that kind of is bearing in on the question. I would be inclined to say that, just as long as we don't, as we recognize that there are certain giftings of the Holy Spirit that are, as a matter of fact, listed in these passages that we are looking at, which go beyond any capacity or concreated ability. We wouldn't want to lose sight of that. Again, I'm hesitant to get too involved in discussion. I want to try to get to a certain point before the end of the hour. So unless it's really pressing, maybe we could bring it up in the discussion hour, or I just kind of waiting around from 1 to 2, I'm glad to talk with people directly after the hour. The apparently random character of the lists, selective character, maybe that's a better word, the selective character of the list should not cause us to miss the fact that each of the charismata may be seen to belong to one of two basic categories: word charismata and deed charismata. These two are, of course, inseparable. They closely supplement each other. And I'm not trying to argue here for any word and deed divorce. However, I think we want to appreciate that the distinction between verbal and nonverbal activity ought not to be overlooked or minimized. There is that distinction. So I think it's useful to generalize then by saying that any particular charisma is either a service in word or a service in deed or ministry. With several, notably apostleship, involving both kinds of service or ministry. And I think that this I think this would be a fair generalization just on the basis of observations that have already been made. But I think that we have some confirmation for viewing the various lists in terms of this basic profile between word and deed. I think we find explicit scriptural confirmation for that in the statement that we have in 1 Peter 4, verse 10 and 11. 1 Peter 4, 10 and 11, which is the only occurrence where we have the only occurrence of charisma outside of the Pauline corpus. And these verses then, 1 Peter 4, 10 and 11, we can take then as providing a brief, compressed sort of overview, not only of what Paul has to say, but of the entire New Testament teaching on spiritual gifts. Peter says, notice now particularly, as I indicated, the basic profile that I'm saying suggested here. Each one of you should use whatever charisma, as each has received a charisma, each should use whatever charisma he has received to serve others. Notice that connection between gift and service. To serve others, faithfully administering God's charis, notice the connection now with charis, faithfully ministering God's charis in its various forms, or faithfully administering the manifold grace of God. Pretty hard to get away from that trend. And then Peter continues, elaborating, if anyone speaks word, he should do so as speaking the very words of God, the logia. If anyone serves deed, he should do so with the strength God supplies. So, we can use that, that verse, as I was saying, not only as pointing to this basic profile of the lists, makeup of the lists, but also summarizing New Testament teaching on spiritual gifts and closing out this section on basic perspectives. That puts us in the position where on Monday we move on to what in the structure of things would be section 4, where we will narrow our focus from this point on to prophecy and tongues.